Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Well, good afternoon again, and we're back to the Vox Pop and Medical Monday, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show, and I'm Alan Chartok. Dr. Garrick Appleby joins us today to respond to your questions and comments. He comes to us from the St. Peter's Sleep Center here in Albany. He specializes in sleep medicine, specifically pediatric sleep medicine and parasomnias. Parasomnia. Dr. Appleby received his medical degree from the State University of New York at Buffalo Jacobs School of Medicine and Biomedical Science. He completed a pediatric residency, chief residency, and sleep fellowship at the University of Vermont Medical Center in Burlington. Previously, he served as the Sleep Foundation Director and Medical Director of the University of Vermont Medical Center Sleep Program. He's a member of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine and the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Appleby, thanks so much for being here with us.
Thank you for having me.
Wasn't the principal's name in Archie Comics Appleby?
I don't know. Maybe.
Oh, I thought it was.
Usually I get references to the restaurant. That's what my day-to-day is like.
Weatherby. Zach told us it was Weatherby, not Appleby. That's right. To be part of today's conversation, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Well, okay, so you're going to be in charge of that. Your wonderful colleague Aaron is halftime now or something like that, right?
Yep, Dr. Scher.
And you're going to, Dr. Scher.
Yeah.
And you're going to be who's been on this program many times and who we love, and you're going to be You know, there have been some advances. When I went through the sleep study, you had to come in and lie on your back and basically be tortured. But
Alan, that doesn't help us out at all.
No. But now you've got something new going, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, we still do what we would call a standard polysomnogram or sleep study, where there's a lot of different channels that are placed, and we monitor sleep and breathing and movement. But more and more, we're also using home sleep testing devices, which help us rule out sleep apnea in the home setting.
Yeah.
Which a little bit pared down as far as what you need to wear and use overnight.
Yeah, yeah.
And pretty good at identifying sleep apnea if you have it. So that is one of the tools that we're using more and more. And patients tend to like it because it's a little bit less intrusive. They can do it at home.
Sure.
And a little bit less wires than probably what you experienced. But
well, what I experienced was having to sleep on my back. But I don't sleep on my back.
Yeah,
well, I sleep on my stomach. I kept going on trying to turn over, and they wouldn't let me.
Well, typically we don't make you sleep on your back. We actually generally like to sleep you sleeping in a bunch of different positions to
really?
See how that might impact your breathing.
I think that's changed.
Yeah.
Because when I was there, they wanted me on my back.
Yeah. We might have to have you back in then, Alan. We got to get you another sleep study.
But at home, and the interesting thing is, I do snore on my back.
Mm-hmm.
But when I'm on my stomach, I never snore.
That's
so in other
common.
Words, I have very common, right? So I have sleep apnea of the back, but not sleep apnea of the front.
Potentially, we call that positional sleep apnea.
Different
positions can predispose to more upper airway obstruction, just because gravity is pushing your lower jaw and therefore your tongue back into that airway space and causing blockage or smaller space, which tends to precipitate snoring.
Okay, so how come I sleep for 4 hours straight? And then every night I'm up for that next hour.
That'll be at least an hour consultation, Al. That's a long answer probably to that question.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different factors which influence how people sleep, whether it's difficulties falling asleep, staying asleep. It can be environmental factors, what you eat and drink during the day and in the evening
like
hours.
Like the coffee I'm drinking now.
Like the coffee you're drinking now, as we were just talking about, might not be your best option.
You took one look at it and you said, put that down.
So there are a lot of different variables and factors for different people, but it's never a bad idea if you are struggling with sleep to chat with your primary provider and then maybe your local sleep doc about what you could do to make that better.
Yeah. The word I was looking for before, a doctor once gave me Valium.
Oh,
Uh-oh.
Yes.
Uh-oh. I'm on the air now. Okay.
So glad it wasn't mine.
Well, you always got to answer your wife's calls. So
well, that's true.
You know. Okay, we'll go to Ellen in Buckland. All right, Ellen in Buckland, you've been patient. What do you got?
I would like to know about talking in your sleep. I don't feel like I'm an anxious person, not with a lot of anxiety, and I about 3-4 months ago, I'm 73 years old, I started talking in my sleep in an anxious way. So can you say anything about that?
Yeah, certainly. You know, talking in your sleep is not generally considered an abnormal sleep phenomenon. It's a very common thing, and we wouldn't consider it really a sleep disorder because it is so common. You know, there's various things which can maybe predispose you to doing certain things. This does fit in that parasomnia category, and a parasomnia is a unusual behavior which you do out of sleep, like sleepwalking, talking, or yelling out, things like that. You know, during periods of stress, sleep deprivation, things like that, those types of activities can be more pronounced, but it doesn't necessarily link per se to any underlying anxiety. So as long as it's not consistent and bothersome to somebody else who's sleeping near you,
right,
I wouldn't worry about it too much.
Okay. I've gone to putting tape over my mouth at night.
Oh, don't do that.
Yeah, don't do that.
It must be really bothersome to someone else then, I take
right.
it. Yeah.
Have somebody else to transcribe what you're saying. I'll bet you're worried about old boyfriends and things. Is that right?
I don't know.
No, I would say that if it's happening now, it'll probably pass. I wouldn't.
Okay.
The less you worry about it, probably the quicker it'll go away. And I would.
Okay.
I would definitely not put tape over your mouth at night.
Okay, but wait a second. Now, what about piggybacking on this question? What about people who kick in their sleep?
Mm-hmm. Kicking in your sleep can be related to a condition we call periodic limb movement disorder, which is a condition where people do kick their legs frequently at night. If that happens a lot, seems to disrupt sleep or really bothers a bed partner, that is something that we would evaluate in our sleep center.
Yeah, and yep. Once you evaluate it, what do you find?
Well, we look at how frequent these occur, whether they seem to contribute to arousal or awakenings through the night. Obviously, how the patient's doing clinically, whether they seem less rested than they would like to be. And then if those seem to be really impacting the patient's sleep, we would move on toward thinking about some type of treatment.
Or say you got to have a separate bed from partner.
Well, that is sometimes people's option.
You may
choice,
have to get but... you may have to get your toes cut. Your nails cut.
Yeah. Well, it's always good to have good nail hygiene on your toes, yeah. I think. But generally, we're talking about, what they're eating, what other medications they're taking, and then looking at iron levels, and if none of those things work out.
Do iron levels lead to kicking?
They can. They can contribute to restless leg symptoms and also these periodic limb movements of sleep. So
wow.
Low stores of iron for some people can contribute to these problems. Right. So checking iron levels is sometimes a good first step.
So Ellen and Buckland, thank you so much for your wonderful call. Appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Mark in Cohoes, who has a major problem. What's your problem, Mark?
Hi, Alan. My wife snores.
Uh-huh.
She kicks, too.
Uh-oh.
But, I'm a very light sleeper, and she snores like I've never heard anybody snore.
Wow.
What can I do without hurting her?
Somehow a light sleeper always ends up with a heavy snore. I think that's one of the paradigms of relationships.
Yeah,
but well, there are a number of things that can improve snoring. Not knowing the specifics to your wife, so no offense to your wife, but weight loss can definitely improve snoring.
Yep.
Avoidance of alcohol or other sedative-type substances toward the evening can help.
You can use the apnea machine.
Well, rarely we use PAP therapy, CPAP therapy for that. We sometimes use mandibular advancement devices, which are appliances worn on the teeth that advance the lower jaw forward to open up the airway space. There are some...
How's that work?
It works. Basically, it increases the space between the base of the tongue and the back wall of the throat.
Really?
Because the more narrow your upper airway is, the more apt you are to snore. So by opening that space up, it's an old physics law, I think Poisson's law, that the narrower that space, the more air force, and therefore the more noise it's going to be made from basically the vibration of the palate and other soft tissue in the back of the airway. So,
have you ever talked it out with your wife, Mark?
Yeah, I have talked to her about possible a device that we've heard of, but she doesn't really want anything to do with that.
Yeah.
She just tells me that I should wake her, and she'll stop snoring. Sometimes I'll tell her to turn over, and that'll help, but only temporarily, and then it starts again, and it's the loudest thing in our building.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the other things I was going to mention, is that generally sleeping in the lateral or side position can improve snoring a bit versus sleeping on the back. But if you've tried all those things and, you know, she was interested in other options, there are some surgical procedures that are done by ear, nose, and throat physicians, which can help. But
that's what you are, right?
I'm not an ENT. No, I'm actually a pediatrician by training, but do both adult and pediatrics in my practice.
All right, well, thanks for your time. I love the show, Alan. I listen every day.
Mark, thank you so much for your good words. Appreciate it. Okay. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the Brattleboro Retreat, providing hospital-based mental health services, including medically assisted alcohol withdrawal. BrattleboroRetreat.org for information. Viva Fresh Pasta, 30 years and 30 wines by the glass. European cuisine infused with flavors of the world. Northampton, Massachusetts. Grab life by the knife and fork. VivaFreshPasta.com. Ellis Medicine, working to help nurses make changes in the lives of others and their own lives. EllisNurses.org for more information. Landis Arboretum, Esperance, New York, offering plant collections, hiking trails, old growth forest, concerts, classes, and more. LandisArboretum.org. And from LARAC, serving the arts community year-round in downtown Glens Falls since 1972, with gallery exhibits and gift shop featuring handmade items by regional artists, larac.org.
We are back, and we are back with an amazing man, Dr. Garrick Appleby, who is from the St. Peter's Sleep Center, and great guy. Okay, so let's go to Linda in Clifton Park. Okay, Linda, your turn. Go.
Hello.
Hello.
I have no problem falling asleep. I have a problem staying asleep.
Me too. Me too.
Yeah, three or four in the morning, I'm up every day.
Yeah, you can call me.
And I can't go back to sleep. I have a difficult time going back to sleep.
Right.
Yeah, I always say that there's two flavors of insomnia, trouble falling asleep and trouble staying asleep, and it sounds like you have the latter. It's a pretty common problem, and there really can be a lot of different variables and factors which contribute to it. Generally, when we're trying to evaluate and treat somebody for insomnia, we're looking at the environment they sleep in, whether you're spending a lot of time in bed not sleeping, because that tends to perpetuate the insomnia. Looking at caffeine intake, alcohol intake, a whole bunch of different factors. So it's probably a little bit tough for me to tell you exactly what to do right now.
Should Linda get up in the middle of the night? If she can't sleep, should she get up?
Generally, if you're not back...
My Fitbit says I'm very restless. I wear a Fitbit to tell me how much I'm sleeping.
Yep. Yeah, the Fitbit basically monitors movement, so it can sometimes be a good approximation of how much you're sleeping. Sometimes it just tends to monitor the fact that you're tend to move a lot at night, and whether or not that correlates directly to how much you're sleeping can be a little bit variable. But
I got one and I lost it.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't help you very much then. But but I think talking maybe with somebody about a bunch of different factors which could help get you sleeping better. Often behaviorally, we can get you sleeping quite a bit better without having to think about going toward medication. And yes, Alan, as you were saying before, if you get up and out of bed, if you're not asleep within about 15 to 20 minutes of being awakened, whether it's trying to go to sleep in the beginning of the night or later in the evening, that generally helps because you don't start to then associate your bedroom with a place where you don't sleep. It's actually getting into bed and falling asleep quicker helps.
No, whoa. No, I'm not done with you yet. Hold on a second. So then what happens? Then what happens when you get up? What should Linda do when she gets up?
Some quiet, relatively boring activity. I don't know what you like to do, Linda. But,
do you knit, Linda?
Puzzles or...
Yeah.
Yeah, knitting, reading a nice book that's not going to get you too enthralled.
Well, how about television?
Television is not our favorite thing because there's the whole light issue about stimulating and impacting circadian rhythms. But a really boring rerun of I Love Lucy isn't a bad idea either. But,
oh, my God. Terrible. Linda, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Okay, bye. We'll go to Jeff in Gardner. Okay, Jeff in Gardner, welcome back.
Doctors, good afternoon. I just wanted to report that my experiment was not drinking any alcoholic beverage for a year and trying to do that like eight glasses of water a day thing. And the biggest thing I noticed was, boy, when I laid down to go to sleep, my breath would come so easily. It was surprising to me
for the eight glasses of water.
I could breathe.
For the eight glasses of water.
And after I went back to having a drink or two, if I didn't have that easy breath, I'd just drink in a glass or two of water before bed, and once again, I seemed to be able to recapture it pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Well, alcohol close to bedtime has a lot of different impacts, which can influence sleep. Generally, it might make you a little bit sleepier, but then often makes you wake up later in the evening, and it relaxes the musculature, so often can worsen apnea and snoring. So definitely, if you're having trouble sleeping, I would recommend trying to refrain from alcoholic beverages in the evening in particular.
What's got me worried
hydration is a big main factor?
I was just going to address that. So if you drink eight glasses of water, you got to pee in the middle of the night. That gets you up, doesn't it?
Well,
no, only about 4 a.m., maybe only about 4, and then you can go right back to sleep if you want to.
Yeah, I mean, there hasn't been a lot of research or literature looking at specifically at whether, certain levels of hydration are going to, impact sleep that I know
because
of.
Because I'm thinking when you breathe, you're actually giving off moisture.
That's true, yeah. I mean, I think that there's been a lot of benefits
from... So if your body is registering that it's critically, dehydrated, your body's not going to want to be breathing properly.
Yeah. I mean, in general, I think being adequately hydrated has been shown to have a lot of positive health impacts. So if it's working well, I would say continue with it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Okay. Hang up. It says here. Hang up. Okay. So now, that was Mark, right? I think that was Mark. So we got to get rid of that. No, that's not. That's a different Mark.
That
was Jeff. Yeah, Mark and Jeff. It's almost the same. 1-800-348-2551. Over the internet, we heard from Trevor. Could the doctor please explain sleep paralysis and what one can do to avoid it? Thank you.
Yeah, sleep paralysis is a feeling that when you wake up, generally your body is paralyzed even though you're aware of the surroundings. And it's usually a very disconcerting feeling. Yeah, it feels very scary because you're not moving, but you're awake. And the first time it happens, usually it's very scary for people. They're not sure what state they're in. Typically, it goes away in a matter of seconds, 30 to 60 seconds or so or less. And it can be precipitated, again, by sleep deprivation, stress, a number of different environmental factors. If it's happening a lot, it might be something that you'd want to chat with your physician about. It typically happens intermittently. And once you kind of are aware of what it is, it's if you just
no big
there, yeah, there's nothing really much to do for that. If it's happening chronically all the time, there are some further evaluations and potentially other treatments that we would consider. But
now Donna says, I have bipolar disorder and I take 10 milligrams of Zolpidem.
Or Ambien,
Also
known as Ambien, yeah.
Also known as, nightly, and have for 3 years. It works wonderfully, but are there long-term side effects?
Well, there probably are long-term side effects to regular use of what we would call hypnotic medications meant to help you fall asleep. The problem being is that many people have been on these type of medications for a really long time, and there haven't been a lot of long-term studies about the usage of these medicines. So I think most sleep doctors would agree that we try to use those type of medications more short-term, with a long-term goal being to implement behavioral interventions that help improve sleep such that we don't have to have medication nightly to have you sleeping better. But what exactly are the long-term impacts when you're talking about 3+ years of usage? I think that we just really don't know that specifically as of yet.
Okay, let's go to Mark in Albany. All right, Mark in Albany is on line number 5. There you go, Mark. I pressed the button.
Two questions. First, can you recommend a home sleep monitor? And second, explain the relationship between sleep apnea and hypoxia. I had a sleep study after showing a number of symptoms of apnea, and I was told I did not have apnea, but I did have hypoxia.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go.
Yeah. So, as far as a home sleep monitor, do you mean like something that monitors how much you're sleeping?
whether I'm waking up.
There's probably, we mentioned the Fitbit earlier, that measures movement, and that can be a relative approximation of how frequently you're awakening, although if you are moving around a lot at night, it might just be the movement factor. I think generally, if you want to kind of evaluate how you're sleeping, I often just recommend keeping a sleep log, a very simple, log next to your bed where you write down day to day how well you think you're sleeping and whether you felt like you woke
up. I do that.
Yeah, I think that's a good first step because that's your perception of how you're sleeping, and that's probably the first and most important thing to know. In regard to apnea versus hypoxia, apnea is actually having pauses or reductions in your breathing for at least 10 seconds or more while you're sleeping at night, whereas hypoxia is just a measure of your oxygen level at night. So people can have apneas or pauses in breathing and not have their oxygen levels change that awful much because they have healthy heart and lungs. And on the flip side, people, if they have certain lung or heart conditions, can have hypoxia where their oxygen levels are dropping at night, but not necessarily have apnea. And that's usually related more to the heart or lung condition than it is the apnea, which is more of an upper airway collapse issue.
Okay. Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it. All right. Christy in Covington. All right, Christy, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wonder if the doctor could tell me what you know about night terrors.
Night terrors are kind of a subtype of what we would call a non-REM parasomnia. So these are unusual events which occur out of non-REM or usually deeper sleep. They're very common in childhood. They typically present as a child or young adult sitting up in bed, usually screaming. They look like they are in terror. They're sweating, generally a fast heart rate. It typically lasts for seconds to minutes, and then the person calms themselves down. They fall back to sleep, quote unquote. But if we actually evaluated that person while in the sleep lab, they would be sleeping through the episode and typically don't remember the episode. So it's a pretty normal phenomenon in children, less so in adults, but typically we don't aggressively treat them with any kind of medication management unless they're very frequent or problematic in some way.
Now, why do some people go to sleep cold and wake up in the middle of the night hot?
That's a good question. Usually it's the other way around, just generally.
Well, in my case, that's exactly the way it is.
Thermal regulation, as we would say in sleep, is an interesting topic, and it relates to your circadian rhythms, your underlying sleep rhythms, a lot of other factors. Generally, our sleep temperature, our body temperature while we sleep goes down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
That's why people kind of wake up often cold in the early morning hours. And when we go into REM or dream sleep, our temperature regulation actually is blunted a bit as well. So there's a lot of different factors around that. But typically it's more so people are waking up cold at night. But
May I ask a follow-up question?
Certainly.
Sure.
Both of my children had night terrors as a kid. And I don't know anyone else whose children had that. And I just wondered if you knew. I thought it was unusual that both of them had it. Causes it?
Yeah,
you know?
it's probably a developmental maturation of the brain that it goes through a period of time where if the brain is trying to arouse from that deep sleep and get to wakefulness, it doesn't quite make it there. So these unusual events occur out of that stage of sleep. It's not uncommon for siblings to have it. It actually tends to run in families, and I don't know if you've asked at uncles, aunts, other family members whether they have these types of events or sleepwalking and related conditions. It does tend to run in families. So from my perspective, it's actually quite a common thing, and I wouldn't be surprised if it happened in siblings. So.
And your specialty is pediatrics.
So I see it a lot. Usually it's managed very well by primary care providers, but if it's happening nightly or really disruptive to the family or the sleep of the child, then I definitely see these patients.
Okay, Christy, thank you.
It's terrifying as a parent.
Oh, it is, yeah. And the odd thing is that generally the less you interact with them, the quicker they calm back down and go to sleep. So that's usually really hard for a parent to do, but usually that's one of the best things you can do is kind of just monitor, make sure they're safe, but not necessarily try to wake them up or engage with them too much.
That's what I tried to do.
Yeah, that would tend to prolong
them back
an event.
To sleep.
Yeah.
Thanks, Christy. Okay, let's go to Margaret in Albany. All right, Margaret in Albany, you're on.
Hi. I'm calling regarding my husband, who has sleep apnea. He was diagnosed about a year ago. he has a severe case. He had about 90 episodes per hour, they found out.
Mm-hmm.
So he's been using his machine religiously the past year, and you know, they monitor it through the machine and adjust it and all that good stuff. And he's doing well, and the numbers show he's doing well. But within the last 2 weeks, probably to a month, he started to wake up in the morning with headaches. And he's kind of blaming the machine, even though his number, when he looks at it on the computer, shows that he had a fine night that night. It was working properly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering if it is common for these headaches to occur using the machine, or if it's maybe something's not fitting right or could be unrelated.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you touch on the fact that maybe something's not fitting right, that's always a good thing to have evaluated, especially if it's been about a year out. Sometimes people need an equipment change to make the mask comfortable. Sometimes the straps go around the head that attach the mask, if they're not positioned properly, or, you know, you're having to really cinch them tighter because they've gotten a bit lax, that can be an issue. Typically, that's what I would be looking for if a patient came in with that issue. I would think that the machine itself is helping an awful lot, it sounds like, so I would encourage continuing use of that. But looking at how the equipment is working for him comfort-wise, and also looking at a lot of other factors that can certainly contribute to headache, would be an important next step, too.
Well, it's good to get that stuff checked out in any case.
Yeah, you know, if there's, you know.
He's got an appointment at the end of the month that I plan on going to him with, just to, because he always forgets something to mention to the doctor.
You know,
so
you should always
bring that up.
Yeah, always go with your husband to an appointment. Otherwise, you'll never know what really happened.
Right.
Well, I'm the one who had to record him sleeping because he didn't believe me when I said, you know, you're stopping breathing in the middle of the night. And when we went in to the appointment and they realized how severe it was, the doctor had said it's usually the wives who find
That's
out.
Right. About
you saved his life.
That's right.
Yep.
Married men live longer for a reason.
Yeah. Thank you, Margaret. Okay, let's go to Summer in North Adams, number 4. Summer, you're on.
Thank you. I was diagnosed with sleep apnea years ago, and I have a mask that I wear at night. But I scream curse words in my sleep. I scream, I kick, I act out my dreams. I've even attacked my partner. And he says that even when I'm wearing my mask, I'm still doing all of that. So I'm still waking up really tired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that symptoms that you're describing may suggest a condition called REM sleep behavior disorder. Typically, during our dream sleep, we should be relatively paralyzed and not be able to act out dreams. But if that is somehow blunted, then you can act out dreams and kind of yell out and do some of the symptoms, you know, some of the things that you're describing. So that is a condition that can sometimes be related to sleep apnea, but can also be independent of sleep apnea. So if you're having those symptoms, even though you're on a CPAP machine, I would definitely go back to your sleep doc and talk to them about that, because you might have to undergo some further evaluation just to make sure that those two things aren't happening at the same time.
Okay, and then I have another question. Why are sleep disorders in the DSM?
Why are sleep disorders in the DSM? Sleep and... I'm not an expert on the DSM, certainly, but...
What is the DSM? Could somebody help me on this?
It's a Diagnostic Statistical Manual for psychiatry diagnoses, if that's what you're referring to.
Yes.
Yeah. So certainly sleep issues and psychiatric issues often go hand in hand. So I haven't read my DSM recently, and I know it was revamped recently, but I would imagine that may be why. But
okay.
Thanks, Summer. Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, let's go to... let's take a couple off the internet. Here we go. I have chronic back pain. I have to move frequently to feel less pain. I got a Sleep Number bed. Am I better off with it set firm or soft? I do not feel rested in the morning. I had a sleep study. They did not find apnea events.
You know, mattresses are a common question that I really just don't have an answer to, I would say. Especially if it's a back pain related issue, probably the person who's treating your back pain would have a better idea of what firmness of mattress you should have. But typically my suggestion is get a mattress that's comfortable for you. So whether that's firm or soft, I don't know what everybody's specific sleep number is, but not a lot of research about the firmness of your mattress related to sleep conditions generally. Mm.
Interesting. Hello, I'd like to hear your thoughts on an online report I read stating that people who sleep on their left side experience various health benefits.
I don't know that I've seen that report. Certainly, side sleeping can have benefits in relation, to, as we mentioned before, to keeping your upper airway open. Right. Your left side in particular might be also related to the positioning of some of the organs which sit on one side or the other. I don't know that I can comment accurately on that, though, since I haven't read that report.
Okay, you'll look it up and do your homework, and then next time we'll
there
hear
you go.
From you. Okay, Zach, take it away. We'll be right back for Ann and Mackenzie and Richard.
Support comes from Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center, offering a Master of Social Work degree, full-time, part-time, day, evening, weekend options, online, in-person, hybrid courses. Adelphi.edu for more information. Saratoga Hospital now offering 3D mammography technology for early detection of breast cancer. SaratogaHospital.org for information. Union Gables Mansion Inn, Saratoga Springs, celebrating 25 years of preserving the Victorian mansion with gardens, wraparound porches, Romanesque pool, fountains, and more, UnionGables.com. Shannon Rose Design, Saratoga Springs, New York, working to help companies and organizations express their identities through corporate branding, web design and development, and graphic design for almost three decades, ShannonRose.com. And from the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, presenting its fourth annual Lake George Hikeathon, July 5th, featuring 14 sites around Lake George. LakeGeorgeHikeathon.org for registration.
And we are back with our wonderful sleep doctor, Dr. Garrick Appleby, got all kinds of answers for you. And let's see here. We'll go to Ann in Troy. Hi, Ann.
Hello.
Whoops. Gotta put
Hello.
That
Hello.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. The reason I called is when you said you're a pediatrician, I had to call because I have two children in their 20s now, and they both wet the bed for years on a regular basis, and I took them to have a sleep study done and to the pediatricians and to a urologist who said everything was physiologically correct with them. No one could give us answers, and he put them on imipramine for years, and they still wet the bed. Mm-hmm. So do you have any insight on that?
Well, you've probably been told that eventually 20. It will stop, and it hasn't, which is frustrating. But
Well, it did, but it was my son was close to 20 years old. It was awful for him.
Yeah. I mean, it can, you know, the... What's causing the bedwetting, certainly when we have chronic bedwetting, which is a pretty normal and actually, especially in boys, a very common phenomenon up until the teenage years, we try to rule out any underlying sleep disorders and or urologic disorders which might be contributing. But honestly, most of the time, there's nothing that we find. And typically, you're looking at either behavioral management, which can sometimes be helpful. There are things called bedwetting alarms, which I don't know if you've tried.
We did that too.
Yeah. And then usually the sort of last resort is trialing medication to, especially in like social situations such as sleepovers or camps and things like that, that can be useful. But unfortunately,
but it wasn't,
there's...
though. So yeah. Was it just that he slept so deeply that he just couldn't wake up?
Well, yeah. And that's sort of, there's not a clear... etiology for us that we can point to. Often that is a pretty common story, that it's a child who sleeps very deeply, doesn't generally wake up easily for anything, and certainly doesn't wake up easily to go to the bathroom at night. So
what about waking them up?
Waking them up is one of the things that sometimes people do. You try to wake the child earlier in the evening after they've gone to bed, but a lot of times parents have tried this, and then it's a struggle to wake them up, and unfortunately for some children, it just, and young adults, it kind of continues into that young adult period. Mm-hmm. And it just takes, for whatever, that link between the brain and the bladder takes quite some time to connect and to make that.
Well, it's more common than they let on then, is it?
Oh, it's quite common, actually, yes.
Okay.
Especially in,
well,
like I said, in
boys.
That's
not the way we were meant to believe.
Yeah, no, it's really, I shouldn't quote statistics I'm not solid on, but there's a good portion of, teenage boys who are still having regular bedwetting or enuresis,
right,
as we call it.
I just wanted to see what your opinion was, because it was a long time.
Yeah, thank and you. It could be very frustrating. But.
Thank you, Anne. Appreciate it. Bye. We'll go to Mackenzie in Valencia. Okay. Mackenzie in Valencia, you're on.
Hi. I have a history question. What is first and second sleep? And that's the way we used to do it. And now we are expected to sleep through the entire night. And if we can't do that, it's considered strange. Can you talk about first and second sleep and what caused that and how it changed?
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly been, it's been pretty popular lately talking about how, you know, we haven't for centuries always expected ourselves to get into bed, sleep 8 hours straight, and wake up and have that be the only correct sleep pattern. I think given our modern schedules, it works well for most people, but there are historical indicators and other indicators that potentially an awakening in the middle of the night during which you can do various things may be a more natural sleep pattern. I think the important thing is when we're evaluating somebody is we're trying to figure out what is the best sleep pattern for them. And I think that's not necessarily 8 hours straight through the night for everybody. But given the social constraints often we have now, the nighttime is really the only time we have to sleep. So there's a lot of interesting literature out there regarding what our sleep patterns should be. I think we're generally trying to work with the patient and their, the environmental tendencies that make them sleep the best. So
mm-hmm. There you go. Okay. Thank you very much.
Fascinating. Thanks.
Bye. Let's go to Richard in Delmar. Okay, Richard and Delmar, you're on.
I'm here.
Okay, man, go.
Hello. Hallway consultation.
Shoot,
that's
Richard.
What I'm requesting.
Oh, certainly.
I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist. And certainly I see my share of children with developmental disabilities, mm-hmm. With mood disorders, with ADHD, etc. And sleep onset problems are really rampant in that population.
Certainly.
And I start off with something like Benadryl or Vistaril, and maybe work my way up to histamine blockers. And after that, I try to stay away from benzodiazepines. But I'm curious if you have any tricks up your sleeve.
Well, I'm always careful to say that there are no FDA-approved hypnotic medications for children. So, but we don't actually do. Right. So I just want to be careful to say that. There are other medicines which I sometimes use, but typically not. Certainly without evaluating the child, and sometimes that depends on the a lot depends on the history and other things, so maybe an offline conversation sometime would be good to have together about what other things tricks I might have, but
two pros.
But I'd be happy to do that, certainly.
Thank you, Richard. Bye-bye.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, thank you. I'll give you a call at work and we'll see what happens.
That'd be great. That's thanks, Richard.
Okay. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We've got two people on the phone. We got three free phones. You want to get in? Now's the time to do it. I'm warning you. Okay, Damien, you're on.
Hi there, folks. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have stage 4 sleep apnea, and it's rather sleep. What happens is my brain kicks me out of stage 4 sleep. I'm on a CPAP, been on it for years. I recently have had problems with nosebleeds that have had cauterized several times. Now, I've been told in the past that the dental devices are only good for a mild sleep apnea, but I've heard of other devices that are out there that are new, like stimulators or whatever, and I'm just wondering what kind of alternatives there are for people who have severe sleep apnea for whom the CPAP is problematic.
Yeah. First off, I would always encourage, if you're having problems with your CPAP, to go back to your sleep provider, because there might be a number of different adjustments or things that we could do to improve things so that it would reduce nosebleeds if that's the major issue. But as far as alternatives, the main alternatives generally beyond weight loss, which can be helpful, are surgical interventions. You mentioned a newer treatment, which is nerve stimulator, hypoglossal nerve stimulator, which is an implanted device which surgically is implanted and and periodically opens up the airway by having the tongue, the base of the tongue basically contracting forward to open up the airway space. We've mentioned earlier the oral appliances, which you just mentioned. They do tend to work better in the population of people who have milder sleep apnea, but you know, those are the basic options out there generally for people. And but I would encourage you, if you're having trouble, definitely go back to your sleep provider, because they could hash out what might work best for you based on your studies.
So, Dr. Abel,
it's not scheduled, but it's not till September, and I was just looking for some information.
So, yeah. Dr. Appleby, I got to ask you a question,
yeah.
And that is, what about you know, saline solutions for somebody who has nosebleeds? In this case,
They can sometimes be helpful. Yeah,
yeah.
You know, keeping the nose moist. I'm not a nosebleed specialist,
yeah.
But that looking at how the humidifier is working and the type of mask you're using can also
right.
be helpful.
Those have been prescribed, and the nosebleeds have been cauterized several times.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So
too bad.
Those are typically prescribed. Yeah.
Thank
yeah.
you. Thank you, Damien.
That can be a difficult
okay.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go to Laura in Ghent. Okay, Laura in Ghent, you're on.
Hello. I was listening to the discussion about these boys that slept so deeply that they didn't wake up at night when they needed to urinate. And my experience and some research has shown that sometimes that's from either food or even airborne allergies that stress them out so much during the day that they then do have the result of sleeping deeply, so deeply that they don't wake up.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to mention that because it's worth doing allergy checks, food allergy checks, even if that's the only symptom.
Yeah, I mean, certainly if that's a concern, that might be a worthwhile thing to look at.
Thank you, Laura from Ghent. Appreciate it. Okay, let's go to Jeannie in Red Hook. Okay, Janine. I'm so sorry, Janine from Red Hook. Go ahead. You're on.
Hi. I was wondering about sleep and menopause. I'm in menopause, and I've tried many different over-the-counter meds, prescription sleep medications, as well as antidepressants that help sleep, and nothing seems to work for me. And I was just wondering if there was something that you thought might be useful.
Yeah, unfortunately, menopause can be a difficult time for people with sleep for a number of different reasons. I would have to plug our sleep psychologist who works closely with us, Paul Glavinsky, because there are often, if you've tried a number of different behavioral and other interventions, medication and other interventions, often looking at things behaviorally can make a big difference. So I think that would definitely be worth having a chat with somebody who knows how to treat insomnia, because there are a lot of different factors which can impact sleep in women going through menopause, but sometimes just some of the basic interventions we make still make a big difference for people.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks
certainly.
Very much. Okay. So now we're on with Brendan. Okay, Brendan, you're on.
Hi, you there?
Yeah, we're here.
Great. I had a question just because I'm a male in my mid-30s, and ever since probably adolescence, I can't get to bed early, and you know, no one seems to understand this. And I sleep through the night, but, you know, it's 1, 2, sometimes 3, 4 in the morning that I actually will fall asleep, and then I'll stay asleep and sleep 8 hours. And I just can't seem to get to bed earlier, and I didn't know if you had any thoughts on this.
Yeah, I mean, it's suggestive of what we would call delayed sleep phase disorder, which is a circadian rhythm condition. Our circadian rhythm underlies our sleep and tells us when we optimally would go to bed and wake up, and for a good portion of the population, that optimal bedtime is not till the early morning hours, and ideally they can then sleep in until the appropriate time that is for their adequate sleep amount. The trouble often being that, as you mentioned, this often starts in adolescence, young adulthood, and if you have to get up and go to school or classes and you get progressively sleep deprived during the week and then sleep in way late on weekends and your parents think you're lazy because you don't get up until noon or 2 o'clock on the Saturdays and Sundays. But it's a real difficult issue with people who are kind of chronically sleep deprived because their innate sleep rhythm doesn't match up with their societal expectations for when they should be awake. So there are definitely things that you can do to help improve that. And that's usually based on timed light exposure. So when you're exposing yourself to sunlight, how you schedule your day, when you get up in the morning, and also sometimes we use melatonin, which is a hormone naturally released by the brain to help train your body into a different rhythm. So it sounds like if this has been this problematic for you for a while, that seeing a sleep specialist would be a good next step, because we could take you through that process.
Okay. Go ahead.
Sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
I have a job that's generally permitted me to be able to be up later, you know, sleep later. And I did try melatonin when I was in college, and it gave me almost hallucinations at one point.
Yeah, I tried it. I didn't like it either.
I think the timing and dosing can be important, but certainly if your work schedule affords it and it works well for you, then really it's not a problem. It's just as long as you're getting an adequate amount of sleep. That's really the most important thing.
I can't help but ask you, Brendan, what do you do for a living?
I teach at a university. I teach philosophy.
Oh, yeah. Well, that philosophy may have something to do with it. Well,
there was an interesting study done, I think it was Sweden, but that people who have a delayed sleep phase tend to migrate toward jobs that allow them to be up late and wake up later. So if that's the case and it doesn't bother you necessarily, then it's really not a physiologic problem.
Well, I don't know. I was a lifelong college professor, and I loved 8 o'clock classes.
Oh, I hate them. I work late. I write late at night, and I'm very productive. It's just everyone else in the world doesn't seem to. They just tell me go to bed early, and I'm like, I can't. And they don't understand that it's not something I can do, you know.
Yeah. Tell them to look up delayed sleep phase disorder.
Thank you, Brendan. Appreciate it. Okay. We'll go to Ellen in Pottstown in Poughkeepsie. Okay, Ellen, you're on.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to ask what the doctor might know about the relationship between the amount of sleep and depression.
Mm-hmm. There's been many, many studies about the link between sleep and both depression and anxiety. Typically, sort of not enough or too much sleep can impact depressive symptoms, and a good number of studies have shown that people with chronic insomnia have higher rates of developing depression. So there's a very close link between the two. And typically when we're evaluating somebody with insomnia, we're also evaluating them for any mood disorder such as depression, because ideally you're trying to treat both of these conditions together to maximize the treatment of both.
Yeah. Thank you, Ellen. Appreciate
okay.
it. Okay.
Thanks.
We'll go to Susan in Kingston. All right. Susan in Kingston, you're on.
Hi. Hello there. I have a problem with insomnia all my life, and I always would wake up when I was a kid, just sit there and look out the window because I didn't want to wake my parents. Mm-hmm. And then I would be really tired the next day, and I couldn't concentrate in school, and I didn't understand a lot of things were being said because I was so sleepy. And this went on for years and years, and when I was a teen, I'd get up, I'd just go out and ride my horse about 2 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. And as I became an adult, I found that I've been sleeping better, but sometimes the insomnia part comes back, and I found that if I get 10 hours of sleep at night, I'm fine. And sometimes if I get 5 hours of sleep at night, I'm fine. And it often can drive me crazy, and I didn't know if there's anything else that I could do about that other than just getting up and wandering around the house, and then, of course, I'll sleep late, and then I'll feel tired all day.
Well, yeah, there probably are a number of behavioral interventions that you could make. We try to, you know, regulate bed and wake time into a more consistent time frame and try to maximize what would be your real sleep need each night. So probably, again, it's a bit of a longer conversation than we have today, but it would be something that you could definitely have evaluated and maybe work through a bit.
Okay.
With a sleep doc.
Susan, thank you so much for calling. And we are just about out of time. Perhaps we could sneak one more in. Nick in Altamont, let's see what you got. Nick.
Hello?
Hey, Nick, we got to keep it real short. What do you got?
Yes, I wanted to recommend deep breathing exercises to help go to sleep. Yeah. It's got no side effects, improves your lung capacity, and it's a win-win situation.
Okay, then we'll get the doctor's answer.
Yeah, there's a number of breathing exercises, guided imagery, a number of different things that can be very helpful, meditative things that help improve sleep.
And you can go
sleep.
Online and you can get the
yeah,
guided
imagery.
Yeah,
there's a lot of different links and options out there to help
okay,
sleep.
Okay, so sorry, Nick. We got to go. Thank you. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. And thank you all for your calls and your emails today. We are out of time. Thanks to Dr. Garrick Appleby for joining us today. You were terrific, Doc.
Thank you for having me.
For doing this. Underwriting support for the Vox Pop comes from Nathan Littauer Hospital, Governsville, New York, proudly introducing the gastroenterologist specialist of Littauer, working to provide patients with comfort during colonoscopy procedures, NLH.org. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.